This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The two-year school Lakeshore College in Cleveland, Wisconsin, is partnering with UW-Green Bay and its Sheboygan campus to launch a new program. They plan to graduate more students with nursing and teaching degrees to address workforce shortages.
The Forward program will allow the two institutions to share resources and students who start their associate's degree at Lakeshore College and finish with a bachelor's degree at the Sheboygan campus of UW-Green Bay.
We're checking in with the leaders from these schools about what this new partnership can accomplish. Michael Alexander is Chancellor of UW-Green Bay. Chancellor Alexander, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Paul Carlson is President of Lakeshore College. President Carlson, thanks so much for being here as well.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Paul, let's start with you. How did this partnership come together? Who reached out to whom?
Oh, this partnership formed almost organically. Lakeshore College and University of Wisconsin-Green Bay have collaborated together for many years. And as Chancellor Alexander and I started talking about acute workforce needs here in Sheboygan County, specifically in teaching and nursing, the ball just got rolling. It just happened organically. Our teams came together and brainstormed how to make this possible over the last 2 years. And we're very excited to be bringing the Bachelor of Science in Nursing and the Bachelor of Arts in Education to the UW-GB Sheboygan campus.
And Mike, what will this partnering with Lakeshore allow you to do that you couldn't do on your own?
Well, I think in all of higher education right now, you're stronger when you can combine resources to the benefit of students and the public. So we do not have the resources to be able to provide all the classes we would need for a four-year nursing or education program on the Sheboygan campus. We have it obviously on the Green Bay campus. But by combining with Lakeshore, we're able to do this in a really powerful way that makes sense for students, right? The students identify by place. And this allows students to stay in Sheboygan to get their degree, which has all kinds of implications for what how much it'll cost them to go to college and providing access for students to get into high demand fields, which is what we're all about.
Can you talk more about that? What is the cost savings here to the students in this program?
Well, if you think about how people go to college, if you think back, if you go back to 1970 or so, the preponderance of people went to college when they were 18 and they spent 4 years in a dorm. Nowadays, that's flipped. The preponderance of people go to college while they stay local. Right. What they're doing is they're already working. They have family reasons to stay home, or they just want to be able to save money to not live in a dorm. And if you think about that, that can save you tens of thousands of dollars over your college education. And so for people in Sheboygan, you know, we know there's a huge need for these fields in Sheboygan. We know that people sometimes either can't or don't want to leave their home. And this is a great way for them to be able to continue their education.
And Paul, why target nursing and teaching degrees? And what are some enrollment goals you have for this program?
Well, the reason we're focusing at this moment on the nursing degree and the education program, it's just we are seeing job growth in both of those fields here in Sheboygan County that outpace both the state of Wisconsin and the nation. So there is a serious need to fill those workforce gaps, and we're excited to fill that. But we're just getting started here. So Chancellor Alexander and I have also talked about bringing a business administration degree and an engineering degree partnership. We look forward to working those out in the coming months and years. You know, this is a new endeavor for both of us in terms of enrollment goals. I can tell you right now, community and student interest in this has been through the roof, which is fantastic, given that we only announced it this past Monday.
And Mike, you know, other UW branch campuses, as you're well aware, have had to close in recent years. How does this sort of partnership affect the sustainability of the Sheboygan campus?
Well, the Sheboygan campus has been growing for about 5 years now, so we're really happy with what it's doing. But to your point, we always have to be thinking about the future, and we always have to make sure we're doing everything possible to make sure that we're not losing a tremendous asset in a community. And we're really lucky to have an amazing campus in Sheboygan when the merger occurred. And we take that really seriously. We believe in the city of Sheboygan. The city's doing amazing things. We need to make sure that we keep a four-year premier university in that city. That's really, really key. And that's why we're partnering with Lakeshore here again, just to strengthen it and make sure, as you say, that it's sustainable for the foreseeable future.
What have you heard from school districts? What have you heard from healthcare organizations in the area? What kind of involvement might they have in this project?
I think, well, first, certainly. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Paul.
No, sorry. I'll jump in there. So the feedback and engagement from our Sheboygan County superintendents has been very positive, both in terms of graduating new educators, but also providing opportunities close to home in Sheboygan County for paraprofessionals who are ready to move on to becoming a teacher. They're extremely excited about. From the healthcare providers, from St. Nick's to Aurora to Prevea, are excited about the investment in nursing and our commitment to growing the nursing pipeline in Sheboygan County.
And Mike, could this be replicated elsewhere at other colleges around Wisconsin? What are the abilities here for other colleges to do what you're doing?
I think it can be replicated for sure. I think what I'm really proud of, if you go to Lakeshore, to uwgb.com, we have a website that lays this out in really transparent terms and what it means for a student and how they navigate the combining the two institutions. It's really clear. I think it's really direct. So the student knows exactly on the front end how that transfer is going to work and how each class will work into the total degree of the 4-year degree. So I think we're really proud of this because we're really grateful to work with Lakeshore, who's been great to make sure that this aligns perfectly, right? So it's transparent for the student right on the front end what this means.
And very quickly, you have a bunch of information sessions coming up in May and June. Is that right, Paul?
Yeah, that is correct. We have an information session on May 19th, May 21st, June 10th, and June 18th. And you can find out more about those by going to www.lakeshore2uwgb.com.
Very good. Thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Michael Alexander, Chancellor, UW-Green Bay. Paul Carlson is the president of Lakeshore College.
Coming up, a new CDC report tracks the number of children diagnosed with autism in the U.S. A Wisconsin co-author tells us that rate has gone up, but that's in part because there were more screenings for the condition.
We are doing a better job of identifying autism and referring children for services than we had in the past.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. This is Wisconsin Today. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows 1 in 31 American 8-year-olds are on the autism spectrum, continuing an upwards trend in the number of children diagnosed with the condition.
And autism rates for children in America have increased nearly fivefold since the CDC first started collecting data in the U.S. nearly 25 years ago.
That doesn't necessarily mean autism is more common. Researchers say a big part of the story is an expansion in autism screening, meaning more kids receive that diagnosis.
But in response to this new research, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. blamed environmental factors for the increase in diagnosis. Kennedy also claimed that autism is preventable and has previously linked autism rates to the use of childhood vaccines, which studies from the CDC and others have refuted.
Maureen Durkin is an epidemiologist and professor of population health sciences and pediatrics at UW-Madison. She's one of the authors of this new CDC report. Maureen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you, Rob, for having me and covering this important topic.
Let's start with this report that you were a part of, came out via the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, looking at the incidence of autism diagnoses for 8-year-olds. You're in the 4 to 8 range. A lot of people focusing on this number, a 1 in 31 8-year-olds with autism diagnoses as of 2022. Can you tell us what went into that number? What kind of research is this reflecting?
Sure. This is public health surveillance where we review health records, autism service records, and special education records, and identify the number of children meeting diagnostic criteria for autism.
And this number, the rate of autism diagnosis in this age group, has gone up over time. And there's two ways to understand that. It could be, oh, wow, there's more autism than there was, or there's more screening for autism than there was. How do we sort out what might be leading to that higher number?
It's difficult to sort out. There are many factors contributing to the prevalence of autism. And yeah, I do think screening is one of them. In 2006, the American Academy of Pediatrics began recommending that all children be screened for autism at well child visits, and then increasing ability to diagnose and refer children for services. And that has certainly contributed to the increase.
Because as I understand it, in years past, you would have had to come to the attention of a medical health provider as displaying a particularly strong signs that could be diagnosed as autism. That is the only way you might get a diagnosis. Now, if we're diagnosing universally in some communities, someone who might never have been looked at as possibly having autism might fall into that category. Do I have that right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. The diagnostic criteria themselves have also been expanding over time. It used to be considered a very narrowly defined condition, and now it's seen as a spectrum with a range of levels of impairment.
A lot of attention to the causes of autism, and we see now from the Trump administration and Secretary Kennedy at the Health and Human Services Department looking to find causes of autism. This is something, as I understand it, that has been pretty heavily studied, and the answer seems to be it's pretty complicated. What are the challenges in figuring out a cause, or more likely multiple factors that might contribute to autism?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges is it's likely to have, it's very multifactorial. There are many different factors contribute to it, and it's probably multiple conditions that get lumped into one category because of the behavioral features are the same, but it's really related to multiple things. There's over 200 genes have been identified that increase the likelihood that somebody will develop autism. And then there are other factors as well. Very preterm birth infants are at somewhat elevated probability of developing autism. Older parenting is associated with an increased probability of autism as well.
Some of the attention, at least from the health secretary, is on environmental concerns. Toxic exposures are one of the phrases that's been used. And some of the research coming from the federal government may focus on what's happening from ages, from birth to age four, birth to age eight. As I understand it, one of the concerns that might miss is what's happening pre-birth. As you mentioned, preterm birth being a factor, there's maybe more relevant things going on during the development of a fetus. Is that right? Is that a place where we would be focusing our attention?
Yeah, that's definitely right. The developing brain, both prenatally and early after birth, is very susceptible to damage due to toxic exposures. We know that from lead poisoning, mercury poisoning, other things that are more detrimental if you're exposed early in life. And there certainly could be toxic factors that are contributing to autism.
We see concerns from parents, people worried that commonly used vaccines might have a link to the development of autism. Again, as I understand it, this is one of the most heavily studied fields in child development and autism. What kind of research has been done to tackle this issue, and what has it found?
There's been studies to see if children who receive various vaccines are more likely to develop autism than other children, and these studies find no such association. So there's really no evidence to date, and as you said, many people have tried to study this.
One thing that leads to people correlating is autism develops as it happens. The signs of autism are detectable at the same kind of age that a kid might be going through their well child series of vaccines. Do you think that leads to some confusion for people who say, well, this happens in this age range and this happens, and take that correlation and look for that causation?
Sure. That could be one of the factors. Yeah. It takes a while to identify autism. It's probably present prenatally, but it takes time over early childhood to identify it. And that is the times that that children are receiving vaccines. But as I said, there's really no evidence. And the people promoting that idea, they keep changing the theories behind it every time one is debunked. For example, early on, they thought it might have been the mercury preservative in the vaccines. Those have been taken out since 2000, and we still see the prevalence of autism continuing to increase.
We're talking about a new report from the CDC finding an increase in the rate of 8-year-olds diagnosed with autism. We're talking to one of the report's co-authors, Maureen Durkin, epidemiologist, professor of population health sciences and pediatrics at UW-Madison. Let's bring things home to Wisconsin. You, I understand, lead a project that monitors the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders and other developmental disabilities in Wisconsin kids. What do we see in Wisconsin? How do we compare to the nation as a whole?
Well, in our most recent report, which is for the surveillance year 2022, the prevalence in Wisconsin is a little bit higher than the national average across the 16 different sites. We're now at 3.8% of children in our state at age 8 years, meet criteria for autism.
Now, there's a bad news or a good news interpretation of that. The bad news, we have more autism than the rest of the country. Or good news, we're doing more screening. We're doing a better job of detecting autism than the rest of the country. Again, how do we sort that out?
I think it is most likely that we are doing a better job of identifying autism and referring children for services than we had in the past. In the national study, the lowest prevalence was found in certain areas in Texas where they are just beginning to develop screening and services for autism. And it remains to be seen over time whether their rates also will start to increase.
Maureen, access to healthcare, these kind of screenings can be very different from one part of the state to another, whether you're populated counties like Dane or Milwaukee versus rural parts of the state. Are there challenges? Are there differences from one part of the state to another when it comes to this kind of diagnosis?
Yes, it's true that in Wisconsin, most of the diagnostic centers and the expertise for autism is located in urban communities in Milwaukee, Madison, but also Marshfield Clinic. There are some rural centers. And there have been efforts over recent years to do outreach using telemedicine to reach rural communities in our state. Nationally, there has been evidence of a lower prevalence of autism in rural communities. And this, we think, is due to lack of under-identification and lack of services.
Are there things Wisconsin could do better when it comes to screening, early screening, screening at the right ages, to make sure we're detecting as many cases as we need to?
Sure. I think it's very important that we have special educational services available for children. And I think Wisconsin has done a much better job in recent years. We used to have a socioeconomic disparity in autism prevalence, and that is really diminished in recent years, and it's a more affecting all children, and more children are being identified and receiving services.
And let's talk about those services, given that there are so many different factors, apparently 200 plus genes to start with, that may be causing autism. What do we need to do to provide services to make sure people with varying kinds of autism can live happy lives?
Well, I think one of the things Wisconsin has done is we have a mandate for any child who's receives health insurance in our state, that insurance must cover services for autism treatments, which can be otherwise prohibitive. They're very intensive, need to start early in life to be the most effective. We also have excellent school system in our state, and it's very important that we provide special education supports for children with autism. And this can begin as early as age 3 years for children with disabilities.
And we'll leave it there. Maureen, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Maureen Durkin is an epidemiologist and professor of population health sciences and pediatrics at UW-Madison. She's a co-author of a new CDC report on autism. If you have comments or questions about anything you hear on Wisconsin Today, get in touch with us right now or anytime. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or let us know if you have an idea for a future conversation on the show. Again, that email, wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new cookbook from a UW-Madison researcher celebrates the favorite dishes of scientists around the globe.
We always talk about we need more STEM diversity, but in fact, what we recognize is there's a lot of diversity, and particularly cultural diversity there that you recognize over a meal with someone.
That's Lab Culture Cookbook. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A UW-Madison scientist wants her colleagues around the globe to pull up a chair at her dinner table and share their favorite dishes.
That pan of enchiladas, or that slice of flan, in fact could help to advance scientific innovation, be the bonding agent for promising collaborations.
A new cookbook highlights the personal stories, favorite foods, and cultural traditions of over 120 researchers worldwide.
UW-Madison professor of genetics, Anna Scope, joins us now to talk about her cookbook. It's called Lab Culture, A Recipe for Innovation in Science. And UW-Madison senior Hareem Rauf worked on the project. Anna and Hareem, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Anna, you had so many researchers across the world contributing to this project. How did you come up with the idea for it?
Part of our job as scientists actually is to take out invited speakers to dinner. And it's actually one of my most favorite things. And I don't think people realize it's part of our job, but it's actually kind of a fun thing. And what I recognized at those dinners was things I had in common with people that I didn't expect. And that I've had some really lifelong friends that have come from those dinners is kind of a really nice, intimate place to really learn about each other in a totally different setting for a couple hours. And I wanted to kind of capture that. But the other bit is I think a lot of young students and the public in general never really hear about the passions that we have as scientists outside of the lab and how maybe similar we are to each other. And I think that's what I really wanted to capture here. And I think I'm also a massive Anthony Bourdain fan. And I think I love to share this quote. Is I think he says, you know, if I'm an advocate for anything, it's to move as far as you can, as much as you can across the ocean, or simply walk across the river. It's to walk in someone else's shoes, or at least eat their food, right? It's a plus for everyone. There is just a misconception of what scientists are, or what they look like, or who they are, and that they're not one-dimensional people. We're very interesting people. We have passions, but we're very culturally different, more than, you know, we always talk about we need more STEM diversity, but in fact, what we recognized is there's a lot of diversity, and particularly cultural diversity there that you recognize over a meal with someone. Mm-hmm. And I have another quote that Martin Luther King said, you know, we fail often to not get along with each other because we actually don't know each other, but we don't know each other because we actually don't communicate or, you know, or share a meal together. And so I think we really need to spend more time and really get to know each other. And I think those boundaries won't be there. And I think a meal is the perfect place,
I love that. And Hareem, so here we are at the intersection of food and culture and science. How did you get involved in the project?
I thought it was a very unique idea, and it would be a cool way to mix in my interest of science and journalism. I love just like getting to know people and their stories and their backgrounds. And even though like it wasn't, I guess, like the traditional research that I was looking for, it was a very cool opportunity, which now that I've switched my major to economics and data science aligns really well with that.
And you were wrangling researchers here on their recipes. So you talked with a lot of the scientists in the book. So when you were organizing it, what did you learn about the recipes or what caught your eye?
It was very interesting to see the diversity in scientists that we have. We have scientists from all different cultural backgrounds, geographic backgrounds, and I think that that wasn't something that I really knew going into it, but talking to them about, just like when I was getting information for their bio pages, it was cool to see that all these people come from diverse backgrounds and the recipes they have to share come from like family traditions or just like their cultures. And I thought that was very cool to see.
Anna, I love how you present the scientists with the question of name the four dream scientists you want as your dinner companions. I realized how many names from scientists I just don't know in these dream guests they listed. What did you learn from the scientists that they called out as dream companions?
Yes, there were several that were very common amongst all of us. One of them is Barbara McClintock, which is my favorite too. But there were scientists I had no idea who they were. We have quite a diversity of science fields, not necessarily biologists, but physicists and engineers. And so it was interesting to see who those people were in their fields that are quite famous and to research about them. It was quite remarkable. There were some commonalities of people we admire, have been our mentors, that we've admired their own paths in science. And I think that was a kind of a unique finding from the book that we didn't expect to happen, but it happened.
And Dr. Diana Chu at San Francisco State named you her dream dinner companion. I mean, tell me you made that dream come true.
Yes. Well, Diana and I eat all the time, but I think we are very, very, we're best friends because we met each other at Berkeley. We were in the same lab. I think I just fell in love with her. She's one of my all-time best friends. That is our experience we love outside the lab, is really enjoying food with each other. And she was the maid of honor of my wedding. I just love her to death.
That's such a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. Hareem, you know, you also asked the scientists to name the foods they hate, which was equally as interesting to me. There's a lot of mentions of ketchup. There's a lot of mentions of like liver and kidneys and various beans. What do you make of the food the scientists dislike?
The ketchup one, I would say, was a little bit surprising to me, considering the fact that like most people I know really like ketchup. I personally don't like ketchup. So it was nice to see that there are other people out there who don't like ketchup. So there were certain spices that people didn't like.
We got a lot of the cilantro soap issues, you know, I mean, real issues. The one that went straight to my heart was octopus. They're just too smart.
Exactly.
Anna, you shared your recipe for Ukrainian Easter bread.
Yes, that's a family recipe. So my dad is Ukrainian. We're Greek Orthodox on my family side. So that bread would take my mother, you know, she would make this bread multiple days ahead of time before Easter. And it was just something that they were so intricate and so remarkably beautiful. My dad spent a lot of time in Scandinavia, so we added herring on the top of it. It was something that reminded him of his mother. And so it reminds me a lot of my father. And it's just something that I actually is a very tactile memory in my brain. It is very real for me and is something I love to do and share with my family and friends.
There is so much love in this cookbook, so many good memories. And so many of the scientists were inspired by mothers or that the matriarchs. I wonder, did you notice that, Anna?
I did. I did notice it. I think things I don't hear that from my colleagues on a day-to-day at work. So it's just how much they revere their mothers. And scientists do travel all the time. And we travel very far. And I think that's the other bit of the book that you'll see, is we put a map at the bottom as where a scientist grew up and where they ended up. There is a lot of travel. And bringing those family recipes and that memory of your family and your mother and your father is a really important part of that.
Hareem, I would imagine this cookbook is going to be with you for forever, maybe all the phases, and you're going to hold this as a really good memory. Is there a particular recipe you've tried?
Yes. So I tried Dr. Sue Biggin's Johnny Cheesecake. I thought that was an interesting recipe because there is like a cheesecake layer, and then on the top, there is like a sour cream topping, which I thought was really good. It's very different than like the standard cheesecake. And in her recipe, like she mentioned that it's very popular in her lab and she bakes cakes for everyone in her lab for their birthdays. So I thought that was very sweet and very cool that she has this story behind it. So that was a very good one.
Anna, I have some intel that you have a particular affinity for cakes. Is that right?
Well, that's true, yes. I make science cakes. So every paper I publish, I make it in cake form and I put it on social media and it goes by viral. And so I've been doing that for a while. So I've always loved to bake. I would probably be a baker if I wasn't a scientist. I really do enjoy it. It's actually very scientific. I had an undergrad professor that told me, never trust a scientist who can't cook. Like, we have protocols that we follow to do an experiment. That's the same thing we do in the kitchen. And so it's identical. But the sharing of the food is a big part of it, too, you know?
Well, Anna and Harim, thank you so much for sharing the cookbook and this project. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Lab Culture, a recipe for innovation in science. It's a new cookbook celebrating favorite recipes from over 120 scientists worldwide. That project led by Anna Scope, professor in the Laboratory of Genetics at UW-Madison, who's also an artist. We also heard from UW-Madison senior Harim Rauf, who was part of the Lab Culture project.